Journalismus von morgen. Der Podcast über Berichterstattung in digitalen, vernetzten Gesellschaften. Mit Michael Brüggemann, Professor für Kommunikationswissenschaft an der Universität Hamburg und Christine Leitner. Nachhaltigkeit, Polarisierung und Digitalisierung sind drei große Themen, die unsere Gesellschaft jüngst immer häufiger beschäftigen und auch fordern. Und zu den Menschen, die sich tagtäglich damit auseinandersetzen, gehören eben auch Journalistinnen und Journalisten. Da stellt sich doch die Frage, wie verändert sich die Berichterstattung in Zeiten, in denen gezielte Desinformationen ihre Glaubwürdigkeit erschüttern? Und was passiert eigentlich mit dem Journalismus, wenn soziale Medien sein Berufsverständnis immer wieder auf eine harte Probe stellen? Antworten auf diese und viele weitere Fragen wird Professor Brüggemann von der Universität Hamburg in der Vorlesung Journalismus in der digitalen Gesellschaft suchen. Dafür spricht er mit Kolleginnen und Kollegen aus der Kommunikationswissenschaft und der Journalismusforschung. Und die wichtigsten Antworten und spannendsten Diskussionen gibt es dann jede Woche in diesem Podcast zum Nachhören. Und damit herzlich willkommen zur ersten Folge unseres Podcasts Journalismus von morgen. Mein Name ist Christine Leitner und ich werde die Themen und Diskussionen in den kommenden Wochen moderieren. Die Vorlesung zum Podcast leitet Michael Brüggemann. Er hat an der Uni Hamburg eine Professur für Kommunikationswissenschaft, Klima- und Wissenschaftskommunikation und leitet auch ein Projekt am Klima-Exzellenz-Cluster der Uni. Näheres zum Thema Journalismus und Nachhaltigkeit hören wir in einer späteren Folge. Heute widmen wir uns erst einmal einem ganz besonders aktuellen Thema, nämlich den US-Wahlen. Bei der Aufzeichnung des Podcasts war die Wahl gerade eine Woche vorbei. Wir wissen also, Joe Biden hat eine Mehrheit und der bisherige Amtsinhaber Donald Trump will das nicht akzeptieren. Über die aktuelle Situation in den USA, den Aufstieg und den Fall von Donald Trump und die Rolle der Medien hat sich Michael Brüggemann in dieser Woche mit Daniel Kreis, Professor an der University of North Carolina, unterhalten. Dass Politiker heute durch die Wohnviertel ziehen und versuchen, die Wählerinnen und Wähler an der eigenen Haustür zu überzeugen, können wir uns heute eigentlich gar nicht mehr richtig vorstellen. Denn für uns findet der Wahlkampf ja überwiegend in den sozialen Medien, im Fernsehen und manchmal noch auf Wahlplakaten statt. Früher war das aber mal ganz anders und wenn wir die Rolle der Medien im US-amerikanischen Wahlkampf besser verstehen wollen, dann müssen wir auch in der Geschichte ein kleines Stück zurückgehen. Daniel Kreis gibt uns hier eine kleine Einführung und erklärt uns, was es eigentlich mit dem Label Intensive Campaigning auf sich hat.
So what do I mean? First of all, labor-intensive, capital-intensive campaigning comes from the great political scientist Pippa Norris. She wrote a book in 2000 that sort of laid out these big sort of epochal shifts in campaigning in U.S. politics, but one that holds, again, across many Western democracies, including Germany. The first is labor-intensive campaigning. This is what it looked like really in the 1800s, up to the early 1900s in the U.S. Politics was deeply social, and it was very performative, often in the streets. Literally, very strong political parties would mobilize their partisans. They would often dress up in very militaristic uniforms. You see banners. It almost looks like folks are going to war. This is from 1860, and it was a rally in support of President Lincoln, who would then go on to be elected president. But what you see there is this massive mobilization. Oftentimes, these were deeply social relationships. So everyone in your local party organization, you knew you were expected to vote for a particular party. People would come to your door if you didn't. In fact, parties printed their own ballots during this era, and they were often printed on colored pieces of paper so that when you voted, everyone knew who you were voting for. You had your party ballot there, and it was something that was very public. I should also say that elections were like really fun. There's a lot of booze. So parties gave away whiskey and rum. And people, again, took to the streets and had these massive, massive mobilization events. And it was all deeply, deeply social in ways that we just can't even imagine now, which is much more individualistic.
Wie sich herausstellte, war diese Art zu wählen nicht optimal. Man befürchtete Korruption, die Einschüchterung der Wähler und sogar Gewalt. Und deswegen wurde das Wahlsystem im 20. Jahrhundert reformiert und hat sich auch mit dem Aufkommen des Fernsehens und des Radios stark verändert.
So a number of reformers got together in the late 1800s, early 1900s to put together a reform movement that tried to make voting much more individualistic, much more a rational citizen model where, the voters would consider the full range of policy positions of each candidate and then sort of make a decision as to how they were going to vote. As the party sort of withered away, in stepped political consultants. And this is what Pippa Norris means by capital intensive campaigning. So this is a photo of Campaigns Inc., which was the US's first political consulting firm, really grew out of World War II. And what they were sort of charged with is packaging and selling candidates for the first time to voters in the mass electorate. And they used all sorts of new technologies like polling. In order to get their messages out, they used campaign advertising and the like. They conducted lots of surveys to figure out what the American electorate wants. But it was much more of a consumer relationship that started to take shape, where candidates were now being packaged and sold based on what they knew the American electorate would be potentially responsive to, the sorts of things that they were interested in doing. A big shift from this party era. Now it is something where, looks much closer to what we think of today, where you have lots of pollsters and professionals who are sort of behind the scenes doing things like running campaign ads. This is probably one of our most famous. This is Ronald Reagan's Morning in America ad, which he ran against Jimmy Carter. But the idea was that back in the day, most Americans were no longer taking to the streets in their torchlight parades. Instead, they were sitting at home watching TV on their couches. And campaign consultants would figure out what was the American electorate going to be most likely to be responsive to. And then they would buy ads on television. And back in the 70s and 80s, you could reach upwards of 90% of the American electorate just running one a political ad on any of the big three broadcast networks during the prime time from 8 to 11. Now that world has radically changed. And this is where we start to get into the technology intensive era of politics. People aren't tuning in to watch shows during blocks of time anymore, usually unless it's sports. Sports is something that still draws a large live audience. But in general, we now have thousands of ways to consume media content. In the US, it's Netflix and Amazon Prime Media and Google's YouTube TV and Hulu. So we have lots of streaming services. People time shift programs all the time or consume content on demand, ultimately, that they want. Live radio is ushering itself out the door as the rise of things like satellite radio on Sirius in the US, or my personal favorite is Spotify, which started in Sweden back in the mid-2000s. So this whole idea that people would be tuning in at a particular moment of time to consume content has largely disappeared. And campaigners have had to keep up with that. No longer could you purchase an ad like Ronald Reagan and reach 90% of the American electorate. You need to figure out how you get people's attention and then what are you going to say to them. So really starting in the mid-1990s and carrying on today, what you've seen is the two big US political parties develop these massive voter databases. This is kind of the core of what the Democratic Party's database looks like. In the US, we don't have silly things like regulation of voter privacy. I'm being ironic. So both US political parties have thousands of data points on every member of the electorate in the United States, and it's totally unregulated. In fact, the courts have interpreted it as a First Amendment issue, so it's a freedom of speech issue. But in general, they have these massive data sets, and then on the basis of that data set, they try to figure out who are the people who are most going to be supporting me, who are the people who are open to persuasion, and who are those people most likely to vote. And once they figure out who those individual people are in the electorate based on the data that they have, they'll then figure out how to mobilize them or make appeals to them in the polls. So in general, what happens is, so the Democratic Party will have this massive data set on every member of the electorate over the age of 18, and it'll have thousands of data points. Some of this data is public data. So when somebody registers to vote, they might mark off what their race or ethnicity are. They'll give their address, they'll register for a political party, et cetera. And their turnout history is something that's public. That then gets melded onto other data, like what's their Facebook account? What's their Twitter account? And then all sorts of other means that campaigns have of knowing people. So what's their email address? They might put browser cookies on their browser and then sync that with particular profiles. All of which gets aggregated and integrated and then becomes the basis for campaign messaging. So in that very top quadrant, you see something that says digital. So once campaigns figure out, we know these, let's say 100 people in the swing state of North Carolina that are registered Democrats, but not likely to vote. What digital companies will then do is take that list of those 100 people and try to advertise to them across many different platforms like Facebook. So the way it works is a firm like Blue State Digital, which is one of the most prominent ones in Democratic politics, will take a list of those 100 voters and go to Facebook and say, we want to run an ad as a custom audience to these 100 people. And then they'll purchase the content and they will run that ad. They might also say to Facebook has a very powerful set of technologies. They'll say to Facebook, we not only want to reach those 100 people, we want to reach another 2,000 that look like them in some way based on whatever matching variables that Facebook is going to provide to them. That's their secret sauce. They don't tell campaigns what that is, but you can run what's called a lookalike audience to reach more people who look like that. Could be people of the same age, the same occupation, the same interests on Facebook, the same liking or sharing characteristics, whatever that combination of stuff is, that's what Facebook does sort of behind the scenes. But that becomes the basis for all these, all the campaigning contemporary. And when I say technology intensive, it's because all modern campaigning has this underlying technological and data framework and infrastructure that lies underneath it that becomes new ways of mobilizing the electorate. And there's one way to look at this. It's to say, well, this is really creepy, right? This is something my students often use. Like, who knows, knew that they have all this data on us and they could serve up ads to us. But it's also something that has that's necessary in order to enable campaigners to adapt with the changing media environment. How else do campaigns actually get the attention of voters in a world where most people don't think about politics all that much? And this is part of the intractable problem, right? So if we make advertising less efficient, that likely also means less voter mobilization, right? So there's real trade-offs there. That's something for policymakers to think about. Okay. What you see broadly then too is this idea that you could take many different types of data to create a view of one particular person. And as I alluded to before, part of technology intensive politics means we have new players involved in the game. So what Facebook does is actually provide lots of consulting services in the political space about how candidates can best use their systems. This is the story of the 2016 Trump campaign. The Hillary Clinton team ran a very traditional campaign. They built up a large in-house staff, hundreds of people doing things like digital advertising. The Trump team didn't have that, but what they did is they had $500 million and they went to Facebook and said, help us spend our advertising in order to win the election. And Facebook, who knows Facebook's own systems very well and has lots of data on its members, said, sure, we'll gladly take your money to execute a large advertising campaign, no problem. And part of the story then is that we have these new intermediaries. And part of the challenge is to figure out what should Facebook's role be in elections. And I know you guys have these debates in Germany as well. I spent the summer in Berlin last year and spent some time with Facebook there, where they were trying to figure out what are the boundaries around the sorts of political services do they offer? Robust disclosure and transparency mechanisms that they should take? How are they going to work with the EU to create a framework for political advertising going forward? All of this reflects the fact that they're now major players in the political communication space, and they're not neutral distribution channels. They actually shape the content of political communication and political appeals. All right, let me just conclude here by saying a few words about the sorting of the American electorate. Really, since the 1950s and 60s with the civil rights movement, what we've seen is the growing nature of social sorting in the US. And let me say what that means. So we have two main political parties in the US. We have the Democratic Party and we have the Republican Party. Now, within those two big party buckets, we have what political scientists call social sorting, where different social groups line up pretty neatly into these two partisan buckets. And that's why we see the intensity both of partisanship and then polarization between the two parties. The Democratic Party is the party of, it's a multi-ethnic party. So we have people in the Democratic Party of many different races and ethnicities. It's a much more secular party, which means it tends to include people who are less religious. It's much more urban as a political party. So the geographic bases of power for the Democrats are urban areas like cities. It's on the whole poorer than the Republican Party. So it tends to be more working class people. That cuts a bit against the narrative that you might often hear. But in general, those are the big buckets or identities that sort within the Democratic Party. Now, is everyone in the Democratic Party secular, right? No. Is everyone in the Democratic Party not white? No. But probabilistically, these are the ways that these identities sort. On the Republican side of the aisle, the party is generally much more white, overwhelmingly a white political party. It's much more religious, particularly white evangelical Christians as being a base of the party. It's much more rural, which means outside of the major urban centers. And it is wealthier on the whole. Now, a big split is education, and education is really interesting. Some analysts sort of say, well, look, you know, actually the Republican Party tends to have people who are less educated. That is true, less formally educated, but often in skilled trades. So trades like truck drivers, plumbers, electricians, and the like, more apprenticeship systems almost. And those are actually well compensated vis-a-vis other types of labor. So when you think about polarization, it's really being driven by the fact that you have two parties that have very different social groups contained within them. And this is really all a product of US post-civil rights movement history, where what you saw in the US on the basis of various elites, this is also a much longer story, but the Republican Party made very deliberate moves to appeal to whites in particular. This is why you see the flip from the Southern white Democratic Party to being part of the Republican Party, but they move very explicitly to be a more express white political party, and that has become their power base over time, whereas the Democratic Party incorporated the civil rights movement and became a multi-ethnic party in a deep way. Now, there's lots of downstream consequences of this. And finally, and this is just kind of where I wanted to end up, this has massive downstream consequences too for things like the media that people consume and the media that people trust. This comes from my colleagues, Yochai Benkler and others at Harvard. They did this amazing study of the online media ecosystem. The key dynamic here is that you can see very solid sorting between red and blue. So these are links that people are sharing based on their partisan identity. So it's very clear that we do have this split between red and blue when it comes to media consumption and media sharing online. But the other thing that's really to note too is that if you look on the left, Democrats tend to have greater trust in legacy media outlets and organizations. That's why CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post all trend a little bit bluer. Those are all sites that Democrats are still consuming. They still have faith and trust in as legacy journalism. On the right, what you see is really the culmination of almost a century now efforts to build a right-wing media ecosystem, one that circulates alternative narratives about politics, blatant lies about politics. This is exactly where all the election fraud claims now lives. It's in that right-wing media ecosystem centered around organizations like Breitbart, Fox News, and the like, which creates a very an alternative and false, ultimately, narrative of things like the outcome of the U.S. election.
Nachdem wir jetzt gehört haben, wie die Wahlen in Amerika ihren Anfang nahmen, wie Wahlkampf früher funktioniert hat und wie sich das Prozedere bis heute weiterentwickelt und verändert hat, wollen wir jetzt natürlich nochmal genau wissen, wie sieht eigentlich die Situation der Vereinigten Staaten nach der Wahl 2020 aus? Im Gespräch zwischen Michael Brüggemann und Daniel Kreis ging es deshalb um die Gründe für den Aufstieg und den Fall von Donald Trump. Und natürlich um die entscheidende Frage, welche Rolle haben die Medien eigentlich dabei gespielt?
The questions that I prepared kind of try to focus this on the rise and fall of Donald Trump. And we should perhaps start with the last factor that you mentioned, which is like the identity crisis of American democracy. So Trump capitalized on this. And like, if I'm a white racist, Trump gave me something to vote for, if I get you right. But why does this explain that Trump won the election and almost, and still has so many voters? It's a minority.
Yeah, great. Okay, so what Trump did was just very explicitly campaign on race. And we have really good political science evidence of this. But in essence, what Trump did was made white racial identity salient to white Americans and gave those people a clear political choice. So he ran on race. He ran on contrasting whites with non-whites. He ran on playing up white status anxieties in a changing country. In fact, we are very rapidly on pace for whites no longer to be the dominant demographic group, at least numerically in the US within the next 20 years. And whites have a lot of anxiety about that. They feel anxiety about their cultural, their political, their demographic, and economic place at the center of the US. So Trump ran on those anxieties and made express appeals to white American voters. It's not just about the explicit white racists, it's about white identitarians. So it's people who Trump has caused a lot more whites to see their racial identity in terms of white and to see themselves as being one social group among many other competing social groups in a very express and explicit way. But they see themselves as sharing some political, economic, cultural, and other interests with fellow whites as an identity group that stands alongside other racial or ethnic groups that exist in the US. What's also key about that is that you see among those whites a rejection of things like the idea of structural racism, of institutional racism. So in the US, you know, we have very clear differences in the economic, health, wealth, fortunes of whites and non-whites, if you look across various groups. This is structural racism. It's baked into the system. It's the result of 200 years plus of policies that have systematically treated white Americans differently from Americans of color. Not every group has experienced those racial structures the same way. Not every member of every group has experienced those racial structures in the same way. But in the aggregate, for example, we know that Black Americans have less wealth. They die sooner. They're sicker. They don't have access to the best jobs. They don't live in a meritocracy in the same way that whites do. So even if whites are not avowedly racist, there is, I would say, among a much more broader segment of the public, whites who are willing to deny across the board, this idea that this that structural racism exists. But I think the key to your question, Michael, is the other piece layered onto this is partisanship. So it could be, for instance, so the Republican Party does have a base, absolutely, of avowedly racist individuals, but far many more people in the Republican Party would not view themselves that way. However, they might be more religious Americans or more rural Americans. They might privilege those aspects of their identity. And at the end of the day, what we know from US surveys, 90% of Republicans pull the lever for a Republican, regardless of who's on the top of the ticket. 90% of Democrats pull a lever for Democrats, regardless of who is on top of the ticket. So this is why you see, even in the 2020 election, right, 70 million plus people voted for Donald Trump, few million more voted for Joe Biden. This is why it can be so split, is because the two parties are much bigger buckets than that. And partisanship trumps, no pun intended, partisanship trumps other considerations of people's identity, because there's many different identity groups that are contained in those buckets. And this is where the talk will get very dark, because I don't think we solve our fundamental issues over identity, over power, over race and ethnicity in the US anytime soon. And I don't think Biden's victory is going to make all this stuff go away. And this is why I think we're in for a very dark era of US politics. My students call me the doomsday professor. So I'm not very optimistic right now, but I think a lot of my colleagues would sort of share this view. Mm-hmm.
But I will still try to see the bright side in this, as you play the professor of doom, because doesn't the Conservative Party have to change their strategy? Don't they have to moderate, because they see we can just reach so many people? It's a minority, it's a small minority, but overall, the majority of people following the logic that is currently in place will vote for Democrats in the end. So shouldn't they, if they want to win, the Republicans moderate their strategy?
Well, I'll give three answers to that. The first is Republicans have been saying that for over a decade now, that they need to change and moderate, and they haven't as of yet. So that's the first one. The second one, I think, is the boundaries around who gets counted as white has shifted over time in the United States. So if you look, I mean, earlier in our history, Germans were not considered white, for instance. Italians and Irish didn't make it into the white camp until the 1950s. There have been some sociologists who have suggested that what you might see are Latinos might be drawn into the white, into sort of that white framework over time. So demographics, we shouldn't sort of assume that these larger racial categories or categorization systems we have are always going to be stable. Those lines can be redrawn in various ways. But I think, and maybe this is where the doom comes in, Michael, I think actually what we're seeing is on full display here is that Republicans might be willing, faced with losses of elections, to just simply reject the legitimacy of those elections. I actually think that this is exactly what's going on now, is that the Republican Party is inching towards becoming a counter-majoritarian party, one where it doesn't play by the same rules of the electoral game, where they have to build a majority, and one where they will engage in things like voter suppression, claims of electoral fraud, voter intimidation, or in this case, moving to outright reject the results of what experts agree are a free and fair election in order to hold on to power. This is why I say we're at a dangerous moment. I think that everything that we've seen in the context of the US right now suggests that the Republican Party is a minority political party. They've lost the popular vote now of every election dating back to the 1980s, and yet have still held power. Based on our various institutions like the Electoral College we have, they might be willing to push that further. I just want to be clear-eyed about the challenges that we face, because I think we know that democracies can fall. We actually have really good research on that. Look at what happened in Belarus. I mean, look at what, you know, look at all these, you know, look at Chile historically. I mean, there's been so many different cases we've had of democratic backsliding that I think we need to be very clear-eyed about the tensions that exist in many Western democracies.
I'm unable to add anything optimistic twist to this last point. So I will move on to the second, like, reason why, first of all, Donald Trump won, which the second factor is like the right-wing media ecosystem, like talk radio, Fox News, then later on, okay, the web with all its blogs and so on. So obviously Trump capitalized on that. But now, watching Fox News during the last couple of days, I was so surprised. The election coverage seemed to me almost neutral.
I think there's always been a split between the Fox News division, with people like Chris Wallace and a very serious decision desk, people who their primary obligations are still towards journalism and professional standards of journalism, and the more opinion side of Fox. So you see this split, which is relatively routine news coverage of the election in accord with, right, an empirical set of facts on the ground about the outcome of the election and who won it. And yet you have Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, like, in the primetime hours at night on the opinion desk, very much sort of working to undermine exactly what the news division is doing. So Fox is kind of at war with itself. And in fact, I mean, there was a report this morning by Axios that evidently the Trump team is reportedly considering trying to launch a digital competitor to Fox because they're upset with the coverage of Fox News on the news side in particular. You know, so I guess I would say, like, Fox has always kind of had that dual role in some ways. And I think both sides of Fox needs each other, right? The news division needs the opinion in order to be credible to their primary audience of Republicans. On the opinion side, they need the news division to give them credibility. So I don't know. I see that in that way. But I mean, I think what we've seen now, I was just, if you follow, there's various journalists in the US who do these crowd tangle analyses of, like, what performs the best on Facebook. And if you look, it's Breitbart, it's Newsmax, it's the, you know, it's all these far right wing digital first outlets that perform the best on social media. So I don't see that ecosystem going away anytime soon. I think social media aids and abets it.
And talking about Facebook, has it learned its lesson, like, from the first election? Like, in the first re-election, you also mentioned, like, this targeted advertising and how Trump capitalized on Facebook. I also remember the Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that Facebook and Twitter, Google less so, and YouTube less so, really stepped up and played much more robust roles this time out, with respect to trying to secure the free and fair U.S. election. And I think they did a number of things. So, as you note, 2016 was an absolute disaster for platform companies. Their systems were compromised. They simply did not anticipate all the ways that, you know, malicious or just strategic actors could undermine public confidence in the vote, can weaponize their systems and the like. What you saw since 2016 is that all the major platforms put a few things in place. I should also say, entirely voluntaristically. We are a failed regulatory state. Our election commission doesn't even have a quorum to make rules governing political campaigning in the US. So, you know, you all have a functioning government. You all should enjoy that. We do not have a functioning government here. We don't have rules around basic things like what Facebook and Google and Twitter did. So they created ad libraries so that the public could see all the different ads that were being run on their platforms. Again, all entirely voluntaristically. They created new disclosure requirements. They all did it in different ways, again, because there is no federal standard. They just came up with it on their own, but they built that and they created that. They gave researchers greater access to things like advertising, and also worked to collaborate with researchers to invite them in to help them work on things. And they've also entirely independently created their own policies of what would govern electoral speech in this space. And they've all done it in different ways, but what I think you've seen is Facebook and Twitter in particular move much more robustly to either flag or label, or in some cases take down speech that was designed to mislead voters, to question the legitimacy of the vote. Donald Trump has been doing this since March and before in terms of questioning the legitimacy of the vote. Facebook and Twitter finally stepped up this year and said, look, we're not going to permit this anymore. Twitter was much more robust. If you look at like Trump's timeline on Twitter, you'll see lots of warning labels that actually obscure the content, and they locked it. So you're not able to retweet it or share it. And as we know from good evidence, like then you see sort of the web traffic to those tweets just drop off a cliff. Facebook has also added labels. I think they can go much farther than they have, but in the wake of any governmental regulation at all, I think that all these companies have taken very robust action. YouTube remains a cesspool and a mess. YouTube has proven unwilling to step in and regulate political content in real ways. But I think Facebook and Twitter absolutely have stepped up and played their role of, I think, much more like media institutions to protect democracy.
So that's a positive thing that they actually voluntarily took steps to regulate themselves. But then what we are just seeing that these new platforms like Parler arise. Okay, I have the French pronunciation.
So
the ultra conservatives will just move there where there is no voluntary regulation.
Well, right. So I mean, I think this is why I keep coming back to like, this is primarily a political problem and not a technological problem. Mm-hmm. When you have one major US political party that is unwilling to abide by free and fair elections, that is unwilling to accept literally the facts on the ground when it comes to the outcome of the election by Republican secretaries of state and boards of election, overwhelming. We have a nonpartisan election system here. Both Republicans and Democrats sit over these systems that monitor them. There has been no evidence of any fraud or wrongdoing, certainly nothing on a systematic level. But when you have a major political party just simply unwilling to accept that fact, then look, they're going to go and find places that exist out there that are going to let them say whatever it is that they want to say. And there's not much that Facebook or anyone else can do about that. And I think that's exactly what's on display. So they're going to go to this new place called Parler. It's kind of a protest vote so that they can talk amongst themselves. I think it's more symbolic than real. I think it's more of a protest. I think what they need Twitter, because Twitter is the portal to the wider American public. That's where all the journalists are. But, you know, it gives them yet another platform to sort of talk amongst themselves and live in an alternative reality where they won an election.
Is there really anything, like, we have journalism students with us here, is there anything that like traditional journalism could do?
Well, I think this is a challenge, right? So in essence, you have the same institutions of professional journalism as the public has gotten much more polarized around them. So the question is, how do you create trust in the sorts of things that you're researching and you're writing about among members of a deeply polarized and identitarian public? What we know from good research is that Trump will tweet, which then sets the agenda of the professional press, not only on Fox News, but on CNN and on the New York Times. And then that stuff is what gets shared on Facebook. So it exists in this much larger ecosystem. And that's ultimately the content that people are seeing and they're interacting with and they're engaging with. There's nothing that requires professional journalists to give a platform and to amplify deliberately false claims. Trump for years have figured out that the more controversial you are, the more that fits into the newsworthiness bucket for journalists, the better it is, frankly, for commercial business, and therefore that's what they're gonna write about. I think it's only really since this election that you've seen journalists in the US be willing to push back on those dynamics. The answer is not much. The one big challenge is that identity trumps epistemology. So as we know from social science evidence, people's pre-existing priors, whether that's partisanship, whether it's religion, whether it's race or ethnicity, will generally shape the sorts of things that they will judge to be true or not. And the only thing that really helps is that you have much more latitude on things that haven't been polarized or politicized yet. So, you know, there's wide swaths of American policy debate that isn't politicized, where the two parties have really staked out a solid ground on. It's just that the big issues, things like abortion in the US, things like racial justice, do have partisan, deeply partisan politicization going on. So therefore, camps are already sorted. So here's a few practical things you can do. The first is, and I think this holds for Germany too, you're most able to persuade if you focus on members of opposing parties, not on members of opposing party, but on debate within parties. So find intrapartisan debate. Here's an example. In the US, Mitt Romney, for instance, who's a prominent Republican, you know, ran for president in 2012, Mitt Romney's often been willing to break with his party on matters. Those are the voices that you should elevate. So people who are out of step with the party, because that then frustrates easy identity categories for partisans, right? It's the same thing with other social groups. So if you're covering, let's say, something that's socially controversial, what I would look to is to find people who share the same identity that might be split on that particular issue. So to use another US example, don't just talk to, let's say, the most radicalized pastors on an issue like the death penalty or abortion. Talk to many different pastors who hold many different views, because there is a lot of variation within views. And that's a key sign to the public that says, oh, there's many people who share my identity that actually disagree on this particular issue. So you have to think about all the reporting that you do in more identitarian terms, and then to think about what are the variations in issue positions or policy stances that exist within an existing identity group, rather than pitting identity groups against one another. Again, to use the abortion example, don't just go to the two sides of pro-choice versus pro-life. Try to find, let's say, the many different people who are religious and deeply religious who have very different views on abortion, because that then frustrates some of that polarization and frustrates things being so easily polarized. You have to find those cross-cutting identities, people who would hold identity divergent stances that exist within various electorates or various publics.
Thank you very much. That was very useful and also kind of even almost optimistic, even there is something we can do. So I'm happy that we ended with our part of the talk with this statement. We also took quite understanding of US media system and the situation in the US. We can also take some lessons for Germany, for our own debates that are polarizing with the populist right party that we also have here. So thank you, Daniel, very much for being with us and taking the time.
Thank you. This is great.
Und das war's auch schon mit der ersten Folge unseres Podcasts Journalismus von morgen. Das heutige Thema: der Aufstieg und Fall des Donald Trump und die Rolle der Medien im US-Wahlkampf. Wir melden uns nächste Woche wieder, dann geht es um den redaktionellen Alltag in digitalen Zeiten. Mein Name ist Christine Leitner, ich verabschiede mich an dieser Stelle, hoffe, dass Ihnen die erste Folge gefallen hat und freue mich darauf, wenn Sie auch nächste Woche wieder mit dabei sind.